Hello and welcome to the last in our special summer series of A Country Breakfast here on RN, where we've been bringing you some of the best stories from our team of rural reporters scattered around the country. I'm Edwina Farley. Today we're off to a special writing workshop in far north Queensland, where young students are busy creating and illustrating their own books under the working title, If I Were a Farmer. We'll also clamber on board a bulk carrier berthed in the Pilbara, and go behind the counter of the Bemboka post office.
It's a very personal job. You have to interact with people remarkably well. Discretion is absolutely essential. A sense of humour is also essential. And I just enjoy the challenge.
Life as a country postie a little later, but first stop today, far north Queensland, where a group of enthusiastic students is getting some valuable advice on writing and illustrating their own book.
We're actually getting the opportunity to study how a book's made, and it's not actually as easy as you thought to make a simple book. It's actually the idea that is the hardest, as you have to make it simple yet you need to get your point across. That's the hardest part.
And getting your point across is exactly what this group of youngsters from across far north Queensland is trying to do. They've been given just 4 days to consider what it would be like to be on the land and then write and illustrate their own book about it. Hello, I'm Charlie McKillop at the Darragee School Camp near Innisfail, where acclaimed Australian children's authors Elizabeth Honey and Alison Lester are overseeing this special writers and illustrators workshop. Elizabeth shares the secret to what's involved in producing an illustrated book from scratch.
A stock whip.
No, actually, they're not blank canvases at all. They've been doing research into farming, and many of them have come along with illustrations and ideas ready to go. So they know the direction they're heading in, and they know that what is asked for, what we're looking for, is a good story that's to do with farming somehow or other. And it can be all kinds of farming. There's fish and cattle and wheat and sheep and exotic things like macadamia nuts and goodness knows what.
Alison, how do you guide these young minds and all of that creativity and energy that I'm feeling in the room?
A lot of these kids live on farms, and when I asked them to put their hand up if they had a farm they went to, they all had a farm that they visited. So it's a pretty rich vein to tap. And once you start talking about that, oh yeah, I've got an idea. So it does just take off.
What highlights can you think of from the week that was, Liz?
I think my highlights are just seeing today, yesterday afternoon and today, seeing the books come together and seeing the ideas growing and also seeing confidence growing, like somebody who says, I'm not a good drawer, but when you make them work in pastel and watercolour in a large medium and really attack the problem because the deadline's tight, and just see them actually enjoying themselves in a way that they hadn't before and they were afraid of, that is the biggest payoff, I think. That's wonderful. I wish people could see the way these kids have really gone for the task they've been given. I wish I could kind of click my fingers and you could look around and everybody could see all their heads bowed over their work, and they're concentrating and they're trying hard, and it's so positive.
There's a good little blah, 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 like there's a really nice conversation. They're working, but they're having little chats and stuff all the time, like it's all going on. I think if we could leave it up to the kids, it would be great. It's always the adults and government that muck things up.
Cassie Brown and Clayton Lilly live several hundred kilometres away from one another. Cassie's growing up on the Atherton Tableland in Land of Cairns, and Clayton's further north in the Daintree Rainforest. The approach they've taken with their books shows the diversity of experiences and ideas that have inspired each of the 65 children here.
My book's just kind of a random idea. I based it off something I heard when I ran around Australia for 2 years, and that's what I based it on.
Tell me about that idea.
Well, mainly we were sleeping in our camper trailer in this little park thing on the side of the road, and we heard this cow giving birth, and I mainly just based it off a cow giving birth to a little calf.
Have you come up with a title yet?
Yes, Misty Blue's Newborn.
I'm Clayton, and
where are you from, Clayton?
I'm from the Daintree. My book is about a goshawk after Cyclone Yasi, when my house got a metre of water through my house and I've lost all of my belongings. And I'm just writing about after a goshawk came and grabbed four chooks out of our chook pen.
Geez, this is a pretty serious subject matter, Clayton. Is there a happy ending?
Sort of. He does get 4 chooks, but all the chooks are fine in the end.
What has it been like to be here in a camp with 2 famous authors being here just spending time with you?
It's been really fun and inspirational because they've taught me you don't have to think big to have a good story. You can have small ideas and widen them out.
Growing up in North Queensland, surrounded by cane fields, banana plantations, fishing boats and cattle, these children may already have had a natural curiosity about farming, but with the guidance of teacher Tanya Simmons, the camps provided the perfect backdrop for these budding young authors.
Morning tea time. I mean, Darajee here, we operate a small little farm anyway. Children come here on camp all the time, on residential camp. We always have poultry, ducks, chickens, turkeys. We hatch them out. There's little hatchlings every week, little cute little fluffy animals for the children. But we wanted to add to that, so we got in some goats, some extra animals for the children. We brought in old tractors and four-wheelers and things so that they could really feel like we had a bit of a farm here for them to relate to. So, you know, we wanted to really create that space and environment that was very rich, and I think from that you're stimulated to produce some rich literature.
Children would have had the richness of background information to draw upon.
Before coming to Darajee, the children were encouraged to interview local farmers to get a personal insight into their lives.
Then we'll move over to Green Hills Cattle Station. So we've got Greg and Carol Ryan.
One of those involved is Greg Ryan. He's from a cattle station 400 kilometres away in the drought-stricken Etheridge Shire, and he's made the trip all the way to the coast to see the results for himself.
It means a hell of a lot. Like, I've really enjoyed it. You know, we might have the next J.K. Rowling or Bryce Courtenay in this group of kids, so to be able to just assist them in our small sort of way is very rewarding, and it's certainly nice to come down and see some green grass in the process of doing that.
I bet that's true, and as you've moved around seeing the work of the children, have your Brahman cattle inspired any of the youngsters?
Well, I think so. Like, there's been a huge variety of sort of things covered in their books, but I've seen some real talent. One girl there, the illustrations were just brilliant. So they're a very talented group of kids, and I'd love the opportunity to have more of a look at their books later on.
It's also been an opportunity, Greg Ryan, for you to get a bit nostalgic yourself. I understand one of the questions you were asked was to recount some of your childhood memories. What did you come up with?
I enjoyed going back to my childhood a little bit and recalling the time when I was first allowed to go mustering with the men. Sort of, I felt about 20 foot tall and bulletproof at that stage, and it was really great to be able to recount that story to these kids.
It's not easy, is it, to lay your personal memories and your life out there for others to see? It takes a bit of a leap of faith.
Yeah, it does, but I think it's important sort of to do that so the next generation sort of gets a bit of an idea of where we've come from and what we've been through, and it may also help to bridge that city-country gap a little bit.
Liam, this drawing you've done here is beautiful, so let's use this one for the cover and see how that yellow bounces off.
Then what will
off
I do, use for the back? Just nothing?
No, I'm sure you can think of something.
Young
else.
Liam Harper is a picture of concentration as he puts the finishing touches on his book, which focuses on the old and the new.
Farming nowadays and then farming 5 generations ago, how they used to cart milk nowadays and how they used to do it a long time ago. How they used to, like, deal with cattle.
Just explain that. You're looking at a beautiful brown cow now with big white dots on it. I love your pictures, but just tell me about this particular page.
It's got a bell because when cows were naughty, the farmers put bells in them so they were easier to find than all the other cattle.
And then in the modern day?
Nowadays they just use helicopters and it makes it a lot easier to find them. This is a picture of my character's great-granddad, and he's cooking bread on a wood-fired stove. The other page is with Dad, and he's cooking food on an electric oven.
So another looking-forward, looking-back scenario?
Yeah. And then on the, second-last page...
Do you want to read that one for us? Just tell us what you've written.
Dad says I'm impatient. He always tells me everything comes to those who wait. You have to wait for the rain, wait for the calves to be born, and grow up before they are milked, wait to get paid, wait for the market to improve. And then on the last page, I got this bit from my interview. Dad always tells me his favourite saying, "It's a joy in itself to wake up at sunrise and look forward to the challenges that the day ahead brings, far away from the hustle and bustle of the city life."
Sorry, I'm a bit slow.
No, that's okay. Take your time.
Note to self: do not walk up a gangplank again carrying a load of recording equipment. It's not an easy thing to do. Nor is finding my sea legs as we manoeuvre up a tight, winding staircase, past the galley and the dining room with its bright, red-checked tablecloths, and into the captain's quarters. G'day, I'm Lucy Bell, and today I'm visiting a bulk carrier that's berthed in the port of Dampier in Western Australia's Pilbara region.
We carry almost everything. We carry paper, we carry bulk, we carry steel, we carry machinery, we carry trains, we carry yachts, we carry sometimes airplanes. If you can think of it, I've also carried Christmas cards. One time we had a dock as cargo, ammunition sometimes, army equipment, everything what fits on the ship.
Good day, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Captain.
I'm not alone today. Seven of us have squeezed into this tiny little office. There's the visiting chaplain from the local seaman's mission. He's here to check on the welfare of the Filipino crew. And we've been joined as well by officials from the Pilbara Ports Authority. And we're all here to meet this fellow, the captain of the ship. He's got an absolutely fabulous name, and I certainly wouldn't do it justice, so I'm going to let him introduce himself.
My name is Hajo van Lozenoort, and the ship is the Elandsgracht. In all the ports, they have problems with the ship's names. Most of the ships are named after the Dutch channels in Amsterdam. Only these days we have more ships than Amsterdam has channels, so now they make up names.
Thank you very much.
We arrived the day before yesterday, and the plan is that we will leave here again tomorrow evening. Then we are heading to the beautiful place in Australia called Windham, in the north, very small place, and there we're going to load some bulk cargo for China. From Windham to China will be 11 days, if the weather will be nice.
And how often would you make that journey?
This is the first time. These ships don't have regular journeys. It's always different. Sometimes you have same trips, but Windham, I've been one time before, but it was 15 years ago. So these ships, you never know where you go and where you end up.
And could you tell us a little bit about the ship? Whereabouts are we sitting?
At the moment, you are sitting in the captain's office, which is, it's okay. You will see it's now with seven people. It's getting crowded already. If you go Africa, South America, then I will have 20, 30 visitors for inspections. Then it will be really crowded. But, you get used to it. And, on most ships, it's like this, the same size.
And what size is this ship and how many crew have you got?
The length is 137 meters and we have at the moment 14 crew. That's a standard crew size.
And we've just come walking up one of those very tightly coiled little staircases to your office here. There's lunch being prepared downstairs and it looks very homely. There were red check tablecloths on the table and lots of different condiments. Does this place feel like home to you or do you miss home?
What can I say? It's a part of life I choose for. I do it already 22 years and when I'm here, it's home. Of course, I miss home. In 1 year, you sail about 6.5 months, and 5.5 months, you're off, roughly. But that's a part of the choice I made when I was younger, and I still make.
And would that be pretty typical of your crew as well? Would they spend a similar amount of time on ships?
No. It's a big difference between the officers and the ratings. The officers all sail about me, same. But if you check with our Filipino ratings, they will sail 9 to 10 months. And they will be home normally only about 2 months. So that's a big difference.
You've mentioned what a quick turnaround it is here. Do you ever get much of a chance to see the cities that you pull into for port?
That really depends, but these days it's getting harder and harder because we are farther from the cities every time. It's getting much more difficult to get there because over here we are not allowed to walk ashore. The only way we can go ashore is by Seaman's mission. And if they are not available, there's no way to go ashore, even if we have the time. So that's a bad thing, but it's getting quite common everywhere. I've been in New Orleans, beautiful, 5 minutes walking from the city, but it was not allowed to walk on the quay. Spent there 3 days, couldn't go ashore.
Thank you very much, Captain.
Crazy moments. My life is it's one big crazy moment, you can say. What's not ordinary, like I said, I had one time a dog and a cat as cargo. Yeah, normally those animals are not used to be at sea, and we had really bad weather, and the cat was really seasick, and at the end the cat almost died. That's something strange doesn't happen too often, but yeah, at the end we asked radio medical advice for the cat, and he got in touch with the veterinarian, and okay, we have that kind of medicine, okay, try a little bit like this, try a little bit like that, and at the end we saved the cat. Owners of the cat were of course really happy, and yeah, for us it was nice thing also. One time I've sunk almost with the ship. Nah, that's not so nice, of course. But it's always, yeah, very changeable. I'm sailing 22 years. If you see waves of 6 meters, most people are sure they are like, waves of 6 meters. And for me, it's like, what's the problem? Well, I've seen waves of 12, 15 meters. Then I'm thinking also like, nah, this is not so nice anymore. You have to go through it. That's the only way.
I'm noticing quite obviously that slight lilt of the ship as we sit in dock. I can feel the movement. You've been doing this for 22 years. Is it hard when you're on land to get rid of your sea legs? Are your sea legs your normal legs?
Actually, when I was really young, I started to learn walking on a ship. My parents had a ship, and then when the ship was moving, I could walk. And then when I was little, I went ashore, I fell over. These days, it's no problem anymore.
It's a very personal job. You have to interact with people remarkably well. Discretion is absolutely essential. A sense of humour is also essential. And I just enjoy the challenge.
What does your local post office mean to you? Is it just a place to buy stamps, collect your mail and pay a few bills? Well, for residents living in and around the small community of Bemboka in southern New South Wales, it's much more than that. It's the glue that holds their community together. Hello, I'm Michael Kavner. Andrew and Sandra Judge have been running the Bemboka Post Office for the past 10 years, a marked change from their previous high-powered corporate jobs with multinational companies. Was it everything that you thought it would be when you took it up?
The business, pretty much. The lifestyle, no. We were actually worried that we were going to be missing out on social activity and that we would be bored with that in a small village. It's turned out to be totally different. The village has accepted us and there is just an incredible amount of things that we do.
There's an ATM at the pub. You also offer cash out as well. If those facilities weren't there, what would it do to the town itself, do you think?
Certainly it would take away from business in town because people would have to go into Bega or up to Cooma to do their banking and get money. Without them, people aren't going to spend in Bemboka because they'll just go into Bega, get their money and do their shopping in there. Not good for the village at all.
With a population of just over 500, there's not a lot of shops in Bemboka. There's a couple of cafes, a pub, a general store and a police station. Outside the 100-year-old timber post office building, there's a huge community billboard full of notices. Inside, Andrew is busy sorting parcels behind the counter, while Sandra renews a gun licence. Local resident Debbie Rollison has popped in to pick up her mail and have a chat.
Thank you. It's the focal point for everybody. I mean, people come together here, maybe they're collecting mail, of course, but it's more than that. They chat, they talk, they make plans, they socialise, and I think that's really critical too. And there's a great deal of trust, a great deal of in the people that run the post office. So I think it means a lot more than just mail. I need to use the banking facilities, I need to use all of the, you know, the in terms of the paying bills, etc. I still think that it's about people coming together. That generates something in people. It generates and produces something in people that keeps them connected within the community. So it means a lot to me, and I know it means a lot, you know, to a lot of other people too. It's pretty important to them.
There's no delivery service around the town itself, so residents need to come in to collect their mail. But there's a separate 240-kilometre mail run to properties in the district. Sandra Judge is getting today's deliveries together.
We have a lot less mail, as in letters, but we have a lot more parcels now than we did when we first took over.
What do you put down the increase in parcels for?
Oh, online buying, eBay. People in rural and remote areas have been hard done by for a long time. What they can source locally is usually a lot more expensive than in the city. For them, the advent of eBay or online shopping means that those great discount places in Sydney are now available to them.
Mail deliveries for you is very different. The majority of people, they come in and pick up their mail, don't they?
Yes, we don't have a letterbox delivery in Bemboka itself.
So how do you actually operate the letter side of the business?
We either put it into post office boxes, so for working people that come in at odd hours, they can get their letters when it suits them. Other people just come into the post office. And for a lot of the community, that's a nice excuse to catch up with other people. And they sit out the front on the bus stop in the sun and have a nice chat. It's a social thing as well as picking up your mail.
How much then of that social thing is the need for discretion on your part?
Oh, absolutely imperative. Anything that is said in the post office stays in the post office.
Do they come along to you almost as a counsellor?
Sometimes people just need to get it off their chest and they know that it's not going to be blurted around, so it's healthy to get things off your chest.
You also have a mail run, but it's not just mail. You also pick up groceries for people and drop them off. How much of that is also a part of the service?
It's all part of the service. We have an elderly couple out in Tantawanglo that just love their newspaper. They're pretty much tied to the house nowadays. So we deliver their newspaper and I think the local shop gives us 20 cents for that. So it's hardly what you'd call a money-making exercise. But it's very important to them that they get it. Another family get food and horse pellets and things delivered because they just can't get out. And it's important that these people do have some form of assistance. And we're driving past their gates, so how difficult is it?
The Bemboka Post Office is vital to people like Steve Martin, who together with his wife runs a mail order business.
It's really a key to our business. If this post office wasn't here, we'd have to drive about 40 minutes and back every morning to run our mail order business. But it's also, this particular post office here is really the centre of the community. It's really the only forum in this town where you get to meet people and chat to people on a sort of a daily basis. And if you need to know anything, Sandra and Andrew here in the post office know. You just ring them up or come in and ask them. A real blessing to the community, I think.
You run a mail order business, so obviously the post office is very important to you on a day-to-day basis. But also, how much of it is a social aspect and also knowing on what's going on in the community?
Well, it's very important. There's a notice board, which we find out everything that's going on in the community. If we want to communicate with anyone, we just put something up or read it on there. And when you're new to the community, like we've been here 3 years now, but we're still needing to find out things, you know, where do you get this, who does that, who minds dogs when you're away, that sort of thing. Yeah, but you just find the people who run these little post offices know everyone, they deal with them every day. They never tell anyone else's business, but they're very helpful.
The parcels going in and out of the post office vary greatly. Horse pellets come and go, as do trays of tropical fruit.
Yes, we have a couple who grow feijoas commercially. They bring them in during the harvest season, which is going for about 5 to 6 weeks. We'll send out several hundred kilos of feijoas during that period of time. The restaurants, airlines, commercial businesses, it's just strange the things that come through here.
Is there anything that you've got to do that makes it a little bit different that is demanded by Australia Post when you're sending something like that?
Any food stuff has to be packed well so that it's not going to leak or be crushed. If it's something like a chilli, we want to make sure that we don't have chilli juice squeezed over everything, so that would have to be in an almost airtight, liquid-proof container. Interestingly, we get truffles come in. We get people who make cheese down here and they'll bring cultures in and they'll ask for truffles to be sent in. And they will send samples of cheeses out. So it's always an interesting job.
Andrew and Sandra Judge keeping the Bemboka community together by running the local post office. Thanks to Michael Kavanagh for that story. Still to come in this special summer series of A Country Breakfast here on RN, we travel to an outback festival in Queensland that raises money to pay for music lessons for local children. We'll meet 12-year-old Georgia Orrick from Culgrass Police Station in the Northern Territory. She might not have a horse, but she does have five pet cows. And while we're in the Territory, we'll stop by Auvergne Station, where a couple of young Indonesian students are getting a taste of station life.
They're fitting right in like they've been here forever. Everyone gets along fine, they're having good fun. It's a bit of an eye-opener for my followers too, because they're willing to find out more about Indonesia, and Salman and Artie want to find out more about Australia, so it's working out well.
Life as a ringer in the Northern Territory coming up later, but first, somewhere cooler. Much cooler, in fact, as we retrace our steps to the winter snowfields to meet the volunteer guardian angels who keep the ski slopes safe.
Morning. Welcome to Territory.
It's hard to put into words, but it's a tremendous feeling to be able to ski up to somebody that is totally helpless on the mountain, that can barely move because of their injuries, and to be able to get them calm, ease their pain, treat the injury, and then get them to the medical centre. People just really appreciate that sort of service when they're in that situation.
All right, so you need to get out over there and catch the tube and be up at Brumby as soon as you can, and
yep.
Watch out for that fence line over there. Yeah. And, all right, so how long are you here for?
Patrol leader Peter Kame is probably someone you don't want to meet when you're on the slopes. It could mean bad news for your much-anticipated skiing holiday. Hello, I'm James Bennett at the Perisher Resort in the Snowy Mountains in southern New South Wales, where Peter and a dedicated band of 163 volunteers are doing their bit to keep the ski slopes safe during the snow season. They're members of the Perisher Volunteer Ski Patrol, a largely unheralded group which funds its operations through member levies and raffle tickets.
Getting ready to head out?
Getting ready to head out. It's a fine art. And you get very sweaty by the time you get on this, without getting yourself all together, but...
Is that because of the amount of equipment you've got?
Yeah, just a bit of equipment, and you pack your lunch and make sure you have everything yourself contained and all your first aid equipment and...
Okay, you boot up, sign on the system, and you're at the door by 10 to 8. We've got a meeting down at the Perisher Centre, and we have to be there by 5 to 8. We talk about, what we need to do in terms of set up of the hill to make it safe for the skiing public. And roughly 8 o'clock, we're all out on the hill, setting up, putting up fences, putting up slow signs, skiing some of the runs to make sure they're safe. And once we're satisfied the runs are safe, we then radio down to the mountain operators and they open those lifts. And the rest of the day is about skiing around, looking for hazards, marking off any hazards that might appear during the day, and attending any people that might be injured out on the hill.
The professional ski patrollers employed by the resort physically can't cover the entire 1,200 hectare site, so that's where the volunteers come into their own. Peter says it takes a special person to join their tightly knit group.
The skiing ability is a very important factor because it doesn't matter how bad the snow is or how steep the run is. If someone's lying there injured, you still need to not only be able to ski in there to administer first aid, but then sled that patient out of that area. And, it's not easy coming down a very steep slope in cruddy snow when you've got, someone that's 120 kilos in the sled behind you. The other attributes are very hard to pick, but we're looking for people that are... can fit into the organisation, can fit into that volunteer mould. Someone that's not selfish is obviously a major attribute.
Who doesn't just want to go skiing?
Yeah, exactly. Look, we all want to go skiing, but, someone that's able to recognise that a job needs to be done and does that as a priority for the safety of others, as opposed to, I'll just do this one powder run first. So, important attributes.
So let's meet some of the volunteers who give up their time to keep the skiers safe and happy.
I'm Rob Rich.
Rob, tell me a little bit about your role today, what you're getting ready to go and do.
Today I'll be heading up to the front face here. We'll have quite a few people skiing, a lot of beginners, and Our job basically today is to ensure that the clients of Perisher have a good day, and our role there is to ensure that we prepare the mountain to make sure that they're in a safe environment. Should they hurt themselves one way or another, we're there to assist that as well.
What attracts you to volunteering here?
It's payback. It's something to get involved in. It keeps us very fit.
Tell me a bit about your background. What's home? What's regular life for you?
Regular life. Currently, I work in an IT environment. Prior to that, I was working as a commercial pilot. So a bit of a diverse career there. Another thing I really enjoy about the volunteer patrol here is the variation of people that are here. There are people from all walks of life. Wonderful, wonderful group of people. Great organisation. We operate as a charity. And to that end, it's a great service that we can provide to the general public.
What's amazing, though, asking around the slopes on a sunny Sunday afternoon, is how few skiers have any idea they're being watched over by Good Samaritans.
Just doing a little bit of a story on some of the snow patrollers here that are actually your volunteers. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
No idea. I don't know. I didn't know. Well, they must be, you know, very keen.
So I was just wondering if you guys knew that some of the patrollers that work on the hill were volunteers.
No? Yes, I did. Well, I did, yeah.
I didn't. I thought they were being paid.
I know some are being paid, but I knew quite a few were volunteers. Yeah, and they spend, I think it's 20 days a year they have to come in so that they can maintain their accreditation or whatever. Yeah.
It's quite a commitment, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it's great, and it's very important. We saw a couple of volunteers bringing someone down from a very difficult place on the Interceptor, and so, yeah, they're doing it for nothing and risking themselves to do a worthy cause.
Like, I had a really bad fall, 5 years ago? And I came, I don't know if they were volunteers, but I came down on one of those, what do you call them, banana boats?
Banana boats.
And they came like within 2 minutes.
The patrol was founded back in 1968. Club stalwart and now Jindabyne local Terry Chalk says many of the original volunteers were surf lifesavers from Sydney who'd taken to the snow.
Grant Turnbull, who was also a legend down here, also came from Bronte. Grant was a lifesaver at Bronte and an instructor down here. And if you came from Bronte and you could ski and you saw Grant, you got a red armband and you're on ski patrol.
When was that?
And that was it. That'd be certainly before 1972 when we were married, probably about 1970, round about then.
As a volunteer organisation, Peter was talking a little bit about, you know, the challenge in keeping the numbers of newer people coming through to keep doing what you do.
It is, because you get people who are interested, who join, and then they go through those life phases. Suddenly they're married, they've got kids, the house, the cat, the car, the job, and time becomes at a premium, and skiing quite often falls by the wayside for a few years. Some of them come back, but by and large we get several years out of people and they drift off. But there's a core of people that have been ski patrolling here for 10, 15, 20 years. There's a small band of us, very scarily, have got badges that say 30 years. Sort of all a bit embarrassing. You hide them in the drawer.
One of the challenges facing the club is their ability to attract new and younger volunteers. Peter Kame's son, Adam, is a member, but admits it's hard to commit 2 weeks a year to the ski patrol.
As a trainee, trying to study at the same time, it's not exactly an easy thing to be down here for 2 weeks of every year. Especially when you're young and your companies want you to work and you want to take time off, so you can come down here.
We find that the younger people, obviously we'd like to attract the younger people, but we're finding that they're quite time poor, and so it's difficult for them to commit, you know, to the minimum requirements.
How do you address that, do you think?
I think advertising's the key. A lot of people don't even realise that there's a volunteer patrol here in the snowfields.
What's the typical reaction?
Oh, they go, what, you volunteer? We thought you work for the company and, work for Perisher, work for, you know, whatever resort. But, so the more we can get word out there that there is a volunteer organisation, or a volunteer ski patrol, I think the more chance we've got of attracting, the younger people and more people to the organisation.
This is Tina. Hello. She
won't hurt you. She's just trying to say hello. Tina, this is the other one I ride. She's sometimes stubborn. I don't have any nuts. No, I don't. See?
When you grow up in the bush, riding a horse is something that you learn to do from a young age. But what if you don't have a horse? What do you do then? Hello, I'm Lauren Fitzgerald. This is the dilemma that confronted 12-year-old Georgia Orrick here at the Colga Police Station in Central Australia, a tiny dot on the map about 20 k's north of the Northern Territory's border with South Australia. With no horse to ride, Georgia turned her attention to some other four-legged animals in the paddock, and now she's got five pet cows of varying ages and colours that she can trot on demand.
Hello?
And who have we got here?
Stanley and Puffer, Tino and Toby and Silver.
We're talking about cows, aren't we? Why have you got a bunch of pet cows?
Well, because I get lots of orphan baby potty cows, because otherwise they'll just be donged on the head, which we like to give them a life and I like to show them.
And you don't just sort of pat them and feed them. You ride them as well, like a horse. How did that come about?
Well, I asked my mum for a horse and she said, no, go and ride your cow. So I did. So I first started off with a milk crate, trying to get on their back. And then I started with a motorbike helmet and then a push bike helmet. And then finally I got on the back and then I started rounding them up in the round ring and hopping on their back, and I just trained them. I don't know how.
Surely you know how. How do you break in a cow?
Well, you round them up in the round ring, and then you start to get them used to you hopping on their back for about 2 days, and then you start getting on their back, and you give them a noise to go on, so like to tell them to go on, and they get used to that, and then once they're used to that, you can tell them how to run or trot, and yeah.
And do you have treats for them?
Yes, I give them pellets. It's a type of a sheep pellet or cow pellet, and they love it. It's delicious to them.
They're all heading off into the sunset now. We were just standing out in the paddock out the back, but now they're heading towards the sunset. Where are they going?
They're going back to the water source where I train them in the round ring. That's where they get feed and water.
And, Georgia, when I walked over here, they all sort of stared at me. They knew that I was a newcomer.
Yeah.
How much time do you spend with these cows?
I normally come out here every day for about 3 hours, about an hour in the morning and 2 hours at night, and I probably walk them around or lead them ready for the show, or otherwise I ride them.
Are they pretty special to you?
Yeah, they're like my babies to me.
And you've got a couple of little ones as well at the moment. How are they going in terms of breaking them in?
They're going good. It's actually quite, I had to let them grow a little bit bigger because their face is very small and they're still on milk. So I have to wait till they're a bit of weaned first and then I'll start training them.
I know you've had a bit of success in the past with taking your cows to shows and things like that. What do you have planned for these ones?
Yeah, well, Puffer and Toby, my two big ones that are about 18 months old now, they've both been in shows. Well, Toby's been in twice and I'm planning to take them in this year as well, plus the little ones that I've broken in. So I'll have a few to show.
Georgia, you go to school via the School of the Air. Do you know anyone else out on any of the stations or any of the remote communities that ride cows?
No, I don't. I'm the only one that I know around this area that rides a cow.
And what do some of the other kids think about it?
Crazy, because they think, oh, you're riding a cow, why don't you just go and get a horse? But I think if you bond with a cow, they know you're good, so you can train them to do anything.
And you've always liked cows?
Yeah, I love cows, especially Poll Herefords. They're my favourite. Puffer. Hello, say hello.
Hello. They're fitting right in like they've been here forever. Everyone gets along fine, they're having good fun. It's a bit of an eye-opener for my followers too, because they're willing to find out more about Indonesia and Salman and Artie want to find out more about Australia, so it's working out well.
For young Indonesian university students Ade Karyani and Salman Hafid, the chance to work on a top-end cattle station is something of a dream come true. The pair has spent the past 3 weeks at a burn station, 350 kilometres southwest of Katherine as part of an industry exchange program run by the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association. They've been gaining practical hands-on experience in a range of skills. They've been fencing, cattle drafting and pregnancy testing, even spending a few nights camping out in their swags looking at the stars. Hello, I'm Carmen Brown, and while it sounds like, and is, a lot of fun, the program has a serious aim: to build a close partnership with Northern Australia's most important trading partner. Dave Young is head stockman here on Auvergne and responsible for training these keen Indonesian ringers.
Yeah, it's a great thing, I reckon. Selma and Nardi seem to be having a lot of fun, and like, it's all new to them what we're doing, and it's completely different to what they know, but it's not stopping them. They're getting right in and having a good time and doing the job.
Now, have you been teaching them a few swear words, a few slang words, some sort of, I guess, our Aussie culture, you might call it?
Not me for say, but...
Of course not.
Nah, they're going well. They're sort of helping these followers learn a bit of Indonesian, and our blokes are teaching them a bit of Aussie slang.
The student program's been running for 3 years now, and so far it seems to be delivering what it set out to achieve. For Salman Hafid, the program is all about gaining hands-on experience. And over the past few weeks, he's had a go at just about every job on the station.
In this morning, we was drafting, and now is we are doing is prec testing for the sell cows. This is the Mr. Dev was prec testing on there, and I'm here, and this Charlie to make sure handling cattle from the dad's yard to the next race.
And has Dave, the head stockman there, has he had you up there helping with the preg testing?
Yes, I was try once, and that is so amazing.
Have you ever done anything like that before?
Yeah, I was study about the preg testing, but it's different because in there is maybe just 1 minute, one person, because that is the university and too many people. And here I can use my hand and I can feel this is a calf in the cow. Yes, it's pregnant.
What else have they had you doing on the station? There's lots of work that goes into running a cattle station. What else have they had you doing?
So many. Because we here, in here was 4 weeks in here, and we was doing everything, like handling cattle with the horse, so many cattle with horse, and we bring the cows is from the paddock to the another paddock, and with the horse. This is a new experience for me because I never tried that in my country. This is amazing.
And have they had you camping out? Have you spent a few nights out in the swag?
Yeah. Like camping every day. That's good because we can see the star, you know, and the people in here is so good. They walk from dark to dark, you know, and that is the walk before the sunrise and after sunset.
They are hard workers on stations. It is long, long days. How have you found that? You've been a bit tired?
Yes, tired is good for me.
So you've never seen anything quite like this, have you?
Yeah, I've never seen like this because I was the fencing, you know, fencing with the Toyota in fencing from the paddock to the other paddock. There's a big paddock and that's great.
You do have a big smile on your face, which says to me you are having a good time.
Yeah.
Do you think you might see yourself coming back to Australia and to the Northern Territory in the future and maybe working on one of these stations full time?
Yeah, that is my dream. Yeah, I like this place and I hope I can back to this place again. And maybe for the next time I can work in here or maybe study in here. That is good country.
Anyone ever heard of the Beatles?
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah? Mostly?
I'm sitting in a small school library in Richmond in northwest Queensland, halfway between Townsville and Mount Isa. Around me, 50 children sit cross-legged on the floor. Even though this song was a hit decades before they were born, they sit quietly and listen, captivated. Hello, I'm Miriam Hall, and hearing a professional musician is a treat for these kids. This town, because of its remote location, doesn't often get performers. Young Clancy is in grade one.
I live on a property. It's really far to town.
I do the guitar at home. Dad helps me sometimes and Mum. I like the rock and roll because it was loud and it was fast.
I am Adelaide and I'm 10. I liked that Spanish music thing because it was quick. It was a guitar.
Yeah. And did you like the sound of it?
Yes, because it was fast and sometimes it was slow. It was like changing a lot.
I think it was pretty awesome because I barely ever hear music like that because not many people come out here.
This school concert is part of the Richmond October Moon Festival, an annual event which brings jazz and blues performers from around the country to the town. The festival raises enough money to pay for music lessons and music scholarships for these children. It's also a chance for locals to come together and enjoy some live music gigs without having to go to the city. Casey Lord started this festival to make sure her community doesn't miss out.
We wanted to do something for the community, and we did a survey, and out of that survey came that there was no music at all taught in the community. So we decided to hold a music festival, and we didn't want it to just be any old music festival. We wanted it to be something, a music festival with a difference. So we decided to call it a jazz festival. And that was 6 years ago, and the purpose was to raise money for musical education in the community. We've now got 12 piano students, 3 violin students, and a music group that comes and goes, and a children's choir of, I think there's 9 in the children's choir.
And it's all because of that festival.
Yes. So, and I think music just sets, relaxes everybody, and it sets a great tone, it crosses all barriers. It's wonderful for a social gathering.
It's not just about your region, is it? You want to try and, I guess, put Richmond on the map for another reason, apart from cattle.
Yeah, I do. And I also want to create something, we all want to create something different in the community. Something once a year we can put on something that just doesn't happen anywhere else in North Queensland.
It must be wonderful for you to see the children performing, knowing that they've had that opportunity to get lessons because of the festival itself.
Yeah, it's lovely. And the other thing we do is we have a scholarship fund, and that scholarship fund funds the musical education for the first year when the kids go to boarding school. Those kids are now coming back and performing at the October Moon Festival, and it is wonderful. It's really gratifying to see. Because often, because we subsidise the lessons, it can be a big drain for parents to then start putting out money for lessons when they go to boarding school on top of everything else. So I think it really helps keep that musical thing going in families.
Yeah, so it's not just at the end of primary school it all stops.
Absolutely.
Why do you think that it's important to have kids learning music? I mean, obviously not everyone's going to go on to have a musical career. Why, even so, did you want to try and invest in something like that?
I think, like a lot of things that parents do, it comes out of your own failed aspirations. I'd love to have been a piano player and never was. But I also believe that music is good for the soul, it's good for creativity, and I think it puts people into another zone. And I think it's important for us all to be able to get away from the business, away from cattle, and be in another zone just for a little while. And I believe music does that to people.
In Richmond, the heat soars to above 40 degrees, but around dusk it becomes a perfect temperature. The evening of the October Moon Festival is no exception, and Melbourne duo Wizard and Oz is on the stage. They've toured around Australia, but never to this part of the country. And after performing, they're spending some time at a local property.
My name's Dave McMillan. I am the Oz part of The Wizard and Oz.
And you too, Andrew, if you don't mind.
I'm the Wizard part of The Wizard and Oz, and I play piano and sing.
What's it like coming to a place like this and playing?
You know, we come away and we just don't realise what people are dealing with, I suppose, you know, the severity of this weather. We don't have any drought problems, and because we don't see it, everyone down there thinks everything's fine everywhere else, you know, where everything's okay, but obviously it's not here. And for us, you know, we come up and we see this and see the way people live. You know, we're lucky we can go to the shop anytime, and we don't have to go 120 kilometres to go and get some milk if we run out, you know.
What kind of impact or what kind of value is it for you as a musician, as a performer, to come out to a place like this?
Great. Yesterday, playing to the children, that was really nice. They were so attentive and joined in and asked questions, and they were interested to react. Yeah, I love it. I'm so tired of trying out on
the road again. At the heart of this festival is developing musical talent of the local kids. 14-year-old Narita is from Richmond and, thanks to the festival, got the chance to learn guitar. She's now at boarding school in Charters Towers, where she's still learning to play.
We don't have a lot of opportunities out here. If you think about it, we don't have a lot of music teachers out here, but the October Moon's helping that.
Why do you think you love guitar so much? What about it do you love?
I don't know, it's just that it can come everywhere with me. It is legit my baby.
What about when you're playing, what is it about playing that you like?
It's the thrill that you get when you're up on stage and then people crowd around you. If I'm in the dorms and I'm practicing, people come crowd around you, go, "Oh, you're so good," but really I'm like, "Oh, I'm just practicing and I don't sound that good at the moment."
The other kids like listening in the boarding school?
Yeah, it's great. They all join in as well. We have a few songs that we all sing together.
Despite the scarcity of teachers, there's no doubt there's plenty of talent in regional Australia. Justin Borg is a mustering pilot and self-taught guitarist and singer who knows how much people love live music.
There's quite a demand for it out this way, and we're pretty blessed that is the case, you know.
People want to hear you play?
Well, I think so. Maybe they're just desperate out this way. I don't know.
But he does worry about the shortage of music teachers and the effect that might have on local kids.
Sort of at a disadvantage a bit because you don't have the same opportunity people do on the coast, and I think that's the biggest thing that we've got to promote out here, because there is such a talent, like you've seen tonight. Like, these young kids have got such talent, but there's no one to bring it out, you know. There's no...
But you do.
Oh, we try. And I'm no musician. Like, I play and sing, and it's something I've taught myself to do. But when you're talking about real musicians that come from the cities and that are educated in music, I think that's what we need to push out here, is to educate kids in music rather than have them realise they want to play music when they're at the age of 25. It's a late stage.
In a way.
Yeah, it is. It's not too late, but you know, it's better if you can kick them off early and have them learn music.
Back before the stage, and Casey Lord says, fundraising aside, it's important for the people of this community to get together.
I think it's really important to come together as a community to do something special, to see your friends, have an afternoon out, swap stories about the drought if that's what floats your boat, or talk about something completely different just for one afternoon. I think psychologically it's really important that people do that.
Casey Lord, the organiser of the Blue Moon Festival at Richmond on Northwest Queensland, ending that report from Miriam Hall. And that brings to an end this special summer series of A Country Breakfast here on RN. We'll return at the same time next week with a brand new series of the program, bringing you an entertaining look at the news and views, the politics and the passions of country Australians. Stay listening to RN. News and Saturday AM are coming up, followed by Saturday Extra. I'm Edwina Farley. Catch you at the same time next week.